What's up, everyone? I'm Chris Hazel, and you're listening to Orchestrated, a music podcast. I hope you guys had a really good holiday season. I know I did. You know, my fairly young family decided to do Christmas at home for the very first time. Normally, we would go out to California and visit parents and grandparents and do the family thing, but this year, you know, we decided to stay put and put up a Christmas tree and decorate and do Christmas morning. And it was like the first time that we ever did that in this house since we moved in a couple years ago. So it was very cool. But I want to ask, you know, as the decorations are starting to come down and you're hearing less and less jingle bells in the grocery stores, are there any fond memories that you're walking away from 2023 with? You know, anything that you're proud of? You know, and as we start to turn our gaze to the new year, like, is there anything that you're really looking forward to? Maybe you have some goals that you'd like to achieve or some experiences that you'd like to have. You know, maybe there's a creative project that you're really looking forward to hopping into. And I just want to say, like, whatever it is that you're looking forward to, I hope that you go into 2024 feeling motivated and inspired. I'll tell you, here at Sin Samples, we have some big things that we're pretty excited about coming up next year. 2023 was mostly dedicated to getting Musio built, fine-tuning the experience so that it's the best that it can be, and packing it full of really good instruments and tools to help foster creativity and musical exploration. And now that we've gotten it to a place where we feel really good about it and we're super excited to be sharing it with all of you, we are expanding our view to include building an online presence that aims to do the same thing. So next year, in addition to Musio continuing to grow, you can also look forward to more interviews and videos and podcast episodes that explore, you know, kind of just what it means exactly to be a musician in today's modern era. Because at the end of the day, our core aim here at Sin Samples is to support music creators like you and to inspire you and empower you and hopefully add value to your own musical journey. So with all of that said, as we're getting those things planned and organized, I thought I'd go back through the Sin Samples archive and see if there was anything worth posting to keep you inspired while we kind of get our ducks in a row for 2024. And in doing so, I came across this brilliant interview from a few years ago with the American composer David Newman. Now, throughout his career, David has scored literally over 100 films. He made a name for himself back in the 80s with movies like Throw Mama from the Train, Heathers, and then later on, some of my personal favorites, you know, The Sandlot, Tommy Boy, Death to Smoochie. I mean, the list goes on. Like I said, it's over 100 films. He also happens to be the son of one of the most influential figures in film music history, Alfred Newman. So naturally, you know, with those two experiences combined, he's just full of a lot of historical knowledge. And he has some really keen observations of, like, you know, the nuances of that history. In the interview, our CEO Mike Patty sits down with David and they talk about his career, what it was like to get started back then, how music transformed filmmaking in the 1930s, and even a little bit about how technology has transformed music today. So needless to say, you're in for a treat. I know I was when I was listening to it. Anyway, I'm going to stop flapping my gums now, and I'll just say I hope you enjoyed this conversation as much as I did. So without further delay, here's Mike Patty's conversation with David Newman.
Thanks for being here with us.
Oh, it's great. I love talking about this stuff. It's just wildly interesting how this all developed. And the Fox stage is part of the development of film music from the, you know, from the 30s when there was actually, you could put mute, you know, sound on films. I mean, it's an amazing history. So as we'll, I'm assuming, get into
it. Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about yourself, first of all.
Sure.
You started off in the business playing violin.
Yeah. I went to USC as a, what we call a violin major. So I got an undergrad degree and I actually started as a piano major, but I ended up as a violin because I was both piano and violin. Mm-hmm. And then I got a master's in conducting at USC in the late 70s. But during that time, I was, you know, we had our little group of friends and we sort of infiltrated and there was so much work in Los Angeles in the late 70s. I graduated in 1976. And so a lot of us that worked, the friends in our thing, we started working in television, film, record dates, jingles, you know. There was probably enough work for 500 or 600 musicians to make a full-time living in Los Angeles at that time. Very different now, but wow. at that time, everything in television was live. There was tons of record dates going on, tons of jingles, jingles or commercials. So it was a blast. You know, I had no intention of writing any music. I wanted to be a conductor, and I was studying conducting, working, getting a master's degree in conducting at USC, and I had a private teacher that I spent hours and hours with studying conducting, and then it just never happened, and I kind of gave up, and then I decided that I'd try for film music, and I had to teach myself to compose to a degree. I mean, I think everyone that's trained in music in a conservatory knows how to write. I mean, you know, you have to write expositions of fugues and do dictation. Hum something, play something, and write it down, of course. But to really learn, and then learning orchestration was just, just terribly difficult.
So as a violinist in this late 70s and 80s, yeah. What were some of the projects you got to work on?
Yeah, I worked a lot for Goldsmith and for John Williams. I worked on E.T. I worked on the first Star Trek movie, which was at Fox. E.T. was at MGM, but Star Trek was a Paramount film. Paramount has a stage, but Jerry Goldsmith.
Yeah.
That loved the Fox stage. And Lionel did a lot of conducting there too. Lionel Newman, who was my dad's brother, who was the head of music for a year, probably even longer than my dad in the 70s and 80s. We played for a whole week, and we recorded about 15 minutes of music in a week, 4 days or so.
Wow.
And they just got all thrown out because Robert Weiss didn't like the music. Jerry Goldsmith is the modernist hegemonic figure of the late 19th century, right? John Williams is kind of the populist. He's brought up as a pianist and in big band. They all know, they're all completely trained in classical. I'm not saying that. It's just Jerry was doing modern composition. John was doing big band stuff. And they became film composers, so they sort of moved, right, you know, into this kind of culture of film music. So Jerry was still in the, like, Papillon, Patton, Planet of the Apes era, which are all kind of modernist scores. Mm. So the original score for Star Trek was kind of like Debussy, like La Mer. It's like a big ship, you know, in the night. And they just, Star Wars had come out, and they just weren't having it. They wanted a big theme and everything, and they just argued and argued and argued. And there are lots of stories, some of them quite funny and weird, and you know, it got pretty crazy that week. So we all went away, and then a month later came back, and then of course that da 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 da, he wrote that, which is a triumphant kind of theme for Star Trek. But it wasn't where they started on the movie. So that was all at Fox, you know.
Oh really?
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Great.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so you did violin, and then so what did the transition to being a violinist to being a composer?
Well, the time I was in my 20s, I didn't want to do violin as a career. I was doing it to make money, and I mean, I loved playing the violin. Actually, once I didn't care that much about it, I really improved. It's a weird thing, but anyway, I wanted to be a conductor, and I was obsessed with it, but it really wasn't constitutionally compatible for me. I didn't like traveling. It was very difficult to get into. You needed to mentor with somebody, either in Europe or at Juilliard, you know, various things. I was more interested in we used to have these platonic discussions about what is conducting. Like Plato would ask, what is justice? Or, you know, what is beauty, right? Why is a Beethoven symphony beautiful? I don't know. I mean, so what is the essence of conducting? It's a nonverbal, you know, blah, blah, blah. And we went into the weeds with this guy who I found just by luck. His name was William Kettering. A lot of film composers studied with him. My brother Tom did, Randy did, and he did a lot of ear training for film composers too, and counterpoint, and you know, it kind of that kind of thing. And then I got married. I didn't want to be a violinist the rest of my life, and so I just decided. Nobody asked me to do it.
Yeah.
And I made a demo and I worked. I started off working with another composer because I just wasn't, you know, and you'd think I'd know how to orchestrate, but I didn't. I played in orchestras all my life. It's a whole different process learning how to orchestrate, you know, even though I knew all this music, it didn't click for me. But eventually it clicked. So by the, like, say, I'd say from about 81, so I worked 76 to about 82 in the studios, and then from about 82 to 85, 86, it took me to get a job. I did a couple of like industrial films and stuff, and then I got a show. I got a Roger Corman film, and then I got this film called Critters, and then DeVito hired me to do Throw Mom from the Train, which I think was 87, and then I was off to the races. You know,
nice.
Once you did a film in that era, there just weren't that many people that could say they had done a studio film. So it was much easier to make a career when I started than it is now, where it's virtually, it's very difficult to make a career now. So
maybe that's a good segue. Yeah. So what does it look like today as a composer, compared to?
Yeah, as a young person, I don't know. I mean, I think there's just so many more people that can do it. There wasn't any technology. Okay, so 86, there is very rudimentary technology to do mock-ups. So that's Elfman starting then, right?
Right, right.
And they're doing mock-ups, but they really don't sound very good. Yeah. Like, I remember a story of Elfman when he did Batman, which was a big film that for John Peters and crazy people at, it's Warner Brothers, right?
Yeah.
Batman, yeah. So he did a mock-up of Star Wars, of the Star, so he played them the Star Wars cue, right? The John Williams cue. And then he played him a mock-up of the Star Wars cue. And he says, look, this is the difference. But this is what you're going to hear on Batman. But see, this is where it's going to get, you know?
So he tried
to educate them as much as you can educate somebody, like, because it was really very rudimentary. So I didn't start mocking up anything till late 80s. So I was I didn't use an orchestrator. I had score paper on my piano and terrible handwriting. And then my first foray into technology was with music engraving. I found a company because I ran the composer's program at Sundance from, I think, 87 to 90 or something. And there was an outfit there. It was called a Rado Music Manuscriptor. They're now out of business, but it was a PC-based, tablet-based thing. And I started using that. Because it really cut down on my copying errors and stuff.
Right. Yeah.
And then eventually I started little by little mocking things up.
And working in a sequencer.
I started in some PC-based sequencer, I forget what it was called. And then I used Vision, you know, opcode, which it doesn't exist anymore, which had some really nice stuff that I wish Logic and Cubase had, but they don't. Like you could stack like 32 sequences and then put them, you could do like little pieces of stuff and then paste it all together and, you know.
Yeah.
But it wouldn't work now because you have to print everything now, you know. But, you know, and then eventually technology. So with technology, it completely opens up the thing. So, and there are all these music schools. I have my pros and cons about that, about paying all that money for a degree in film composition when it's going to be so hard to get the money back that you might have borrowed to go to school. At least it's not 4 years. It's not like going to law school or med school, but it's still, I don't know that they really help you get a job or really are honestly explaining to you how weird this is, you know?
I think that the best way to learn is to like assist another composer, right?
Yeah, but then you get stuck.
Actually just doing it is.
Yeah, I don't know. There are pros and cons of that too. You know, you might not be, I could never have worked for another composer. I wasn't constitutionally able to do it. It's hard enough for me to work with an orchestrator. I've hardly ever had anyone ghostwrite or assist me writing on a series. I've seen people get stuck in mentor intern relationships, and so I don't know. I the only advice I can give a young person would be to have a well-rounded education. Because mm-hmm. I know, and try to get your music to editors, not music editors, not directors, but editors, yeah. because they right. cut in music. They don't care where it came from. They'll cut in music while they're filming. Mm. And if you can get your music to an editor, that's you have a much better chance of somebody listening to it and seeing, what it is. And then the other thing is have a well-rounded education, be well-read, be no theater, no music, opera. You never know what a director is going to be interested
yeah.
in talking about. You want to be an interesting person to talk to,
So it sounds like it's almost like you want to have the foundational musical stuff established. But, and the technology is something that is just a tool that you use.
Yeah, but a lot of people, there are a lot of people now that, are some of our biggest composers don't read and write music. The Beatles didn't read or write music. They celebrated not reading or
right.
writing
yeah.
music. Again, I'm constitutionally unable to even, I do not judge it. I just cannot imagine making music without being trained. Mm-hmm. I don't think training does anything in terms of how good you are as a composer, because I think yeah. composition is a procedure of choices. You do something and you think on it, and retrospectively you edit it, and you
right.
I don't think that has anything to do with training. It just, I would think it would be terrifying to be a musician and not be really well trained. But
right.
there's a lot of that now. It because the technology is so good. I basically orchestrate everything in Logic now. And because it's pretty damn good, Logic at transcribing, because you can there are a lot of things you can do with notate, because it comes from a notator. It has a little bit of a DNA of notator. And then what was it after notator? It was
eMagic.
eMagic. Yeah. That's what it was. And they have a DNA of that. They don't allow you to quantize the duration, which is a problem. Mm-hmm. But you can make it look right, quantized in the notation without quantizing the music, because as with samples, quantizing samples sometimes just doesn't work,
So obviously technology has changed, yeah. right? I mean, we can talk for hours about stuff everyone kind of already knows.
Well, yeah.
But what are the similarities between the craft of film music, in my opinion, it's really been the same, would you say? Are there any similarities between it was, in the 70s and 80s? As there are in scoring pictures today.
I mean, you can look at epochs or stages of film music, from 1930. I'm fascinated now by the early 30s, because there wasn't any film music till 1930, 31, and they struggled for years to try to figure out what it was. Hmm. My dad was a large part of that. He was here in 1930, Max Steiner was here, Franz Waxman was here. In 1934, Korngold came from Vienna. I cannot express how famous George Korngold was. Eric Korngold was in the 30s. He was as famous a musician as there was in the world at that time. And he came to do Midsummer Night's Dream, and that all mixed up. And you get 1939, you get Gone with the Wind, you get Wuthering Heights, you get Wizard of Oz. It's kind of a mature art form by then. It's basically Wagnerian leitmotiv with Italian arioso kind of melody singing. So it's leitmotivs, and that there's a theme for a character, and the themes are Italianate, and then they're kind of song-like. They have song structures, kind of, four bars, eight bars, or whatever. Or it's like Jaws, like a two-note motive or something, Right. And that is what it became. But I wouldn't say that's what it is now. I think it's fundamentally different now.
Interesting.
Film technology has changed so much. Most of all, the means of distribution have changed. So with social media, short form stuff, I think look at it all. Look at TikTok, look at YouTube, look at all that. That affects what movies are. Mm. And I think movies, the way they historically have been, I don't think they will cease to exist by any means. But I think it's a different business now. Mm. And you know, money, like how much a film made over this weekend and how much this made this much money. And in these, you know, this obsession with how much money it made. Okay, yeah. But when you compare it to the money that Apple and Google and our world now, where you're talking hundreds of billions and $1 or $2 trillion companies, the whole film business is $6 or $7 billion. It's like nothing, you know. That I think that's what's affected a change. And I think film music has gone a little bit down on the scale of what it used to do to tell the story. I don't think it's really thematic right now. Okay. It's more, I wouldn't say it's sound effects, because it is thematic. It's just not thematic in the same way.
I see.
I mean, I that's a fairly nuanced statement, and it's my opinion. I you know, of course, there still are movies that have themes and stuff, but really up to a certain point, as you said, it was, you could really follow it, that it was this. Yeah, in the 60s, it became Mancini and Alex North, and, you know, Goldsmith did, you know, Planet of the Apes, and, you know, and John did a bunch of very modern-ish scores, and then, you know, and then you get Jaws, which is a complete change, disruption, and Star Wars, which everything is, you know, Star Wars. And we are sort of still in the Star Wars universe with Marvel and stuff.
Yeah, so I wonder, because you mentioned technology, because, there's all these streaming platforms and all this stuff, and the amount of content that's required nowadays, it's immense.
Yeah.
And so the timelines for composers, and you know this, have shrunk.
Yeah.
And to create, I mean, how has that affected the quality, the type of scores that we write?
I just think there's so much more, it goes so much faster. There's less money being bandied around. It just affects the quality. It just does. It's the nature of it. You know, too much money is a bad thing too. You know, when you have unlimited money, you get, you know, excesses and screwy things too. But too little money is, that's the normal thing. Mm-hmm. Too little time, too little money, too little understanding of what music is there for. Those guys really thought about in the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, John's generation, Goldsmith, John Williams, Goldsmith, they really thought about what music is doing there.
Yeah.
I mean, if you think about it, unless music is constantly through the movie from beginning to end, where you start and stop is like a monumental decision. Mm-hmm. When there's no music in a film or television or even a YouTube, you know, there's no music, and then all of a sudden there's music, it doesn't even matter in a certain sense what the music is, just the fact that there is music there. And then when it ends, the fact that it ends, it's making a statement. So what I find now is they want you to try to hide making a statement, what the 30s generation would call a commentative music. Music that is commentating in real time on what's going on in the screen, or setting something up for later, or all the things that we would think of as that style of film composing. That is not what people are asking for now. Mm. They think it's giving away the story to comment, for the music to comment on it. So it's more like, I would say, and again, this is my opinion, it's more like diegetic stuff. It's like, is there something in the picture that makes this okay to have this music here or something, you know? Not that they didn't do a lot of that in the 30s and 40s too, because they had these huge research departments, and there are lots of films that are basically source music based or song based. You know, think of like Casablanca is all based on a song, all of it. Mm-hmm. I mean, almost the entire score is based on a song. It's like a theme and variations of a song. So they weren't opposed to doing that. Or like my father's film scored How Green Was My Valley, which probably a lot of your viewers won't know, but it was a very famous late 40s. So it's based on a Celtic folk song or a Scottish folk tune. And they researched, you know, this. And there's a lot of source music in it that is put together with scoring and stuff.
Yeah.
But I think now, go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, I would say that, well... On a positive note, I think that there have been, I mean, although rare, there's been some good scores that come out.
Yeah,
when you're working with, a director that can trust you or a director that's being trusted to let the composer do what they want. I've seen, you know, obviously Silvestri still gets to put out a good score once in a while. I mean, and John Powell and some of these guys are really doing great work, but it's rare and it's unfortunate because, you know, if we let composers do what they really can do, I think we
It doesn't happen instantly, this stuff. Yeah. It's, you know, it's like, of course there's still going to be movies and theaters and you know, but it's inevitable. You can see where it's going and you can see that the film industry itself is kind of not really even facing the issue. If you look at what the Academy is doing and when people talk about film and theaters, you know, you don't really get a good understanding of that they really understand what's going on, you know, and try to, you know, figure out what they can do to, you know, to figure out how to make this happen, you know.
But it's like, it's also, there's other areas of media that are just exploding beyond film. Yeah. That a lot of
the
us,
short form,
that are making a living, getting to write these big symphonic scores with themes, like in the video game industry, really is lending itself towards this kind of composing.
Yeah.
And I do a lot of stuff for like the Disney parks and, you know, we can actually write a theme and stuff like that.
Well, they want you to, because then it makes sense. What I'm saying is with what you see in film, feature films, and what you hear of composers and directors, I don't want you to do anything. I don't want, this is too much. You're commenting too much.
But it makes sense.
Yeah. And maybe the movies can't handle it. It's probably, you don't know till you actually write it and look at it if the movie can even handle anything commentative at all. Where you're, have a theme and it comes back and you recognize it from before, which is the essence of the Wagnerian leitmotiv, you know, which is 1850. I mean, that's back to, you know, that period of time. I mean, Wagner's really the grandfather of film music, even though it's generally not Germanic. As I said, it's more tuneful and a little bit easier to comprehend, but still the idea of a theme for a thing, a character, or a feeling is, that's completely Wagnerian.
Let's talk about your dad, Alfred Newman.
Yeah.
He probably was the modern inventor of film music that we know of. And
Can I tell you a little story? I conduct at the Bowl every year. John Williams is so gracious. He lets me split a program with him every year around Labor Day. And they're like rock concerts at the, I don't know if you've ever been
to the Hollywood Bowl.
They're like rock. They're great. Yeah. They're crazy.
Right. We all went. The whole Cine Samples crew was there. Okay. We were cheering you on.
Oh, so you heard my story.
Tell it again.
Well, my dad and Gershwin Gershwin was born in 1899. My dad was born in 1900. They both lived in New York. You know, my dad was born in New York. He's the only great father of film music, what they call it, that was born in America, but just barely, you know, 20 years from Russian Jewish parents. And he was a child prodigy, and they were dirt poor. There were 10 of them that lived in a one bedroom, one bathroom apartment in New Haven, Connecticut, where a bunch of Russian Jewish immigrants lived. But he was a prodigy. His mother recognized it, got him lessons, and he was making a living by the time he was 12, 13 years old, doing vaudeville and everything. So he met Gershwin when he was probably 14 or 15, because Gershwin was a song plugger at a publishing house on Tin Pan Alley, which was 28th Street in New York, between 5th and 6th Avenue. And there were a ton of them, and they were selling sheet music. Sheet music was the only way to play popular music. There was no recording, right? Mm. And so they met, and then they met again in 1920 when my dad took over for Max Steiner, who was music directing a show called Dear Mabel, which was just some friggin' show that Max Steiner got sick. It used a bunch of Gershwin songs, and my dad took over. And then him and Gershwin became friends. And the stage manager was George Cukor. So George Cukor, Max Steiner, Alfred Newman, and Gershwin are all doing, and they're all 20 years old, and they're in New York. It must have been awesome, by the way. And they have no idea what's coming. And in 1930, not Gershwin, but all those three are in Los Angeles, in Hollywood, early 1930, right when talking films are becoming commercially viable. And Steiner and Alfred Newman, as I said, Waxman, later Korngold, they invented film music. Mm. You can read, if you are so inclined and can find it, them discussing this. What do we do? Do we have music at the beginning, at the end, just in between scenes? It wasn't evident what to do. And the director said, why should we have any music here? We don't have any. It was more like they wanted to do like what 19th century melodrama would have been, where a play and you have a scene change, you have some music.
Right, right.
No music during the scene because it's a play, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe we do that. Or maybe we're like silent film. We just babble on with music through the whole thing, but don't do anything, you know, right. just do. And then they talked about trying to educate, they said, or talk these directors into letting them write some more original music because they were still like interpolating things. And like, there's a story of Steiner with King Kong, 1933, they test the movie and people are laughing at the stupid special effects. And Steiner begs King Vidor, who was the director, please let me write an original score. I'll scare the pants out of it. And he does. He writes an original score and it completely changes. It becomes a big hit, which is the genesis of everything in Hollywood if it makes money, right? And people like it. And there were all kinds of things, Alfred Newman doing things, you know, and they eventually figured it out. And my father was at UA, United Artists, which is basically Goldwyn, which is over on Formosa and Santa Monica Boulevard. It was that studio. That had the best scoring stage of all in Hollywood. It was the first to go, but it was the best. That's where Best Years of Our Lives was recorded.
Oh, wow.
I don't know if you know that recording.
Oh, yeah.
So he stayed there till 39, then 39. He wrote the logo for Daryl Zanuck, I think 1933 or 34, but he wasn't under contract yet to Fox.
The 20th Century
Fox
to 20th Century.
So, the first part of it, not the with the extension. The first part, that was the end.
Right.
So any fanfare up till 1954, that's the fanfare. It's like 9 seconds. It doesn't have the da-da-da-da. That was later, which we can talk about if you want. So 1939, Daryl Zanuck hires him, and then he's at Fox for 20 years on that gorgeous scoring stage, which they totally figured out where to place mics. And my dad was obsessed with microphone placement. Mm. It was really the only... Placing microphones is how you mixed music. Mm. And his idea, because of his training, is like when you sit in a great hall, you sit in Carnegie Hall or the Philharmonie in Berlin or the Konzerthaus in Vienna, you know, you sit in the 10th row, it's just perfect. Mm. You hear the sound stage, you hear where everybody is, but it's all blended. You don't hear any individual violin playing, you know, unless it's a solo or something. So it's all about the blend. That's very hard to get in a studio. So you would get it by where you place microphones in a particular room. Hmm. And you experiment, you know. I think I told you this story about MGM. If you go and, you know those rafters at MGM, you can climb up those.
Yeah, I've been up there.
Have you been up there?
Yeah.
There are marks for How the West Was Won, which was in 1963. Because he had a whole session just for microphone placement. Because he was freaked about it because he had been freelance for a few years. He had done everything at Fox. They had all the microphones exactly where they wanted. If they needed to do, say, some more big band stuff, they'd move the microphones. You know, that's how they mixed.
It
was literally, literally hanging microphones. I hope you can get your hands on some of the pictures because you can see the mics, how they did it. I don't think they used a tree. Maybe they did. I think they use single mics like way back against the back wall. I'm sure there's people you can ask about it. It's completely fascinating to me because the mic placement, when I was playing a lot, I tried to sneak in and hear what I could hear, and different engineers would place the microphones in different places. And really, to get the sound of a symphony orchestra like that, like as if you're sitting in a hall, it's very hard to do. And you have to have the ear that's what you want. And maybe you don't want to do that, you know. So
was this the first time then that they were figuring out how to record an orchestra?
Well, they were figuring it out
in a studio. Like
yeah,
that.
Well, they were figuring it out in the 30s, but the technology initially was so bad. You know, that's why there's a lot of tuba and the trumpets don't sound very good in early films. You know, but the technology developed so quickly that, as I said, you get from 1930 to 1939. You listen to Gone with the Wind, and it all sounds like film. I mean, yeah, it's not the greatest, but it sounds like a film score.
Right,
but
right.
If you listen to films 31, 32, which are completely fascinating, I highly recommend your viewers and everything, just check out, like my father did a 1931 King Vidor movie called Street Scene. It was a New York Broadway play. Very little music, but there's enough music in it. And just see how it's used and you think, why isn't there any music here? Why, but... If you take the ride from beginning to end, you can see what they were up against, what they were trying to figure out how to do it. Hmm. But by the late 30s, by the time he got to Fox, in their own ways, him, Steiner, Franz Waxman, Korn Gold was at Warner Brothers.
Oh, yeah, so
Steiner was at Warner Brothers. You know, who am I? Tiomkin, Dmitry Tiomkin, the Russian. Mm-hmm. Maybe he was at Paramount. I don't know, but they. All these had studio orchestras, full-time orchestras. Basically, it would be like, you know, Haydn or that era. They have an orchestra at their disposal 24/7. They have to pay them a certain number of hours a week, whether they use them or not. So they're just on call. They're all so happy to be there, the musicians, because they're getting way more money than they would playing in the LA Phil or Philadelphia. So you've got great musicians. You've got all these musicians flooding in from Europe. Jewish, Russian Jewish, Viennese Jewish, German Jewish. They all have great instruments because it wasn't expensive to have great string instruments. You can't imagine what a difference that makes. Mm. Having a beautiful violin, cello, viola, and a bow. It violins, bows, cellos can go from sounding like horrible to being like God made it. So a Stradivarius violin or a Del Gesu, a Guarneri violin, you know, costs millions of dollars now. Then it was, you know, 20,000. Yeah, it's something you could afford. Or a bow now, a tourte bow, the French bows or the bows. They all had this stuff, you know, would now cost $200,000-$400,000. It would have cost $2,000 then. So
And these musicians, they also had to learn how to perform in a studio.
Exactly.
So that
they were taught because Max Steiner and Alfred Newman, as I told you before, they came from Broadway. That they learned conducting in Steiner did in Vienna and then here. You know, there's a lot of popular music, and Vienna's a big popular music city too. It's a waltz city. It's a very weird place. It's a fun loving, you know, it's not Brahms and Beethoven just. There's that too in opera, but there's a lot of pop music that's in the DNA. So Korngold comes. That's why he just was naturally good at film composing. He had an opera. Die Todesstadt was an opera he did in the 20s when he was just a kid. It's still in the repertoire. I mean, he was that famous, and he came here. He wanted to go back, but he couldn't go back. Now none of them could go back till. After the war, till 45, and many of them didn't go back, you know. Okay. So
I wanted to talk about, Alfred was running the music department at Fox. So what was that like?
Okay.
Who was working under him? How did that,
39 to 59.
Yeah.
30 to 39, he's working at United Artists on the lot at UA, there, which was, I said, on Foremost. I don't know what they call it now, but it's still there, the studio. Not the recording station. He's working principally for Samuel Goldwyn. So basically, he answers to no one but Samuel Goldwyn. He's given a budget. He does whatever he wants. Somehow, he figured out to zero in on Sam Goldwyn politically, and then he could do whatever he wanted. Daryl Zanuck was desperate to get my father to Fox from 1933 on. That's why he didn't write the logo for Fox. He begged and begged and begged, and finally my dad acquiesced in 1939. It was kind of a crossover year. And he worked there. The only person he reported to was Daryl Zanuck. Everything else was run almost as a despotic dictator. it is completely unique, I think, in this kind of environment. Though, you know, they all had a lot of power, obviously. But Alfred Newman and the Fox Music Department, you can talk to John, and, you know, all these guys. It was another universe, you know.
So who
John
some of,
came out of a
yeah,
jury,
right.
You know. Bernard Herrmann was working at Fox in the 40s before Hitchcock. You know, Bernard Herrmann was impossible to work with. My dad could care less what a jerk he was, as long as he delivered, as long as he was talented and delivered, he just didn't care. And if you weren't, you were so gone.
Wow.
He was scary, my dad. I mean, he could, but he loved talented people as long as they delivered. But that's arrangers, composers, you know, orchestrators, arrangers, orchestrators. The library, that library is still there, basically. They still have this library. It didn't get thrown away like MGM or this ridiculous stuff of the, you know, Disney has a good library. But everything was under there. Under his, basically, his control. And he was very good at delegating. Once he liked somebody and trusted them, he would delegate authority. But he taught those musicians how to do this, how to play in this style of what you would think of as golden age Hollywood film music, which I would call this hyper rubato style. There's always been rubato. You hear about Mahler and the way Wagner conducted and Brahms conducted, that there rubato means slowing down, speeding. It's really a term of like stolen time in Italian, but it's ebbing and flowing. And he principally did it under dialogue, but it became stylistic.
Yeah.
And it was just in its zenith in the late 40s and 50s on at Fox and the stage. And as I said, they set up the mics for this. And when they would have like a solo, they'd have a soloist, they'd have a solo mic, and you could hear. It's more of a chamber music-y sound than it is a huge orchestra sound. The winds and the brass are a little more defined, punchy. They're a little less roomy. They're still roomy and it's still blended. So for instance, the Fox Orchestra of the late 40s and 50s on these big films, they'd have triple winds, which, you know, 3-3-3-3, but they wouldn't do it like that. They'd go two flutes, two oboes, five clarinets, and two bassoons. And the idea was the clarinet family is the mellowest single reed, right? And it's the mellowest part of the woodwinds that have the entire range. He'd have maybe an E flat, two B flats, E flat contra, which is not generally used. It's a wood kind of symphonic band instrument, and then the contra. And he would use that to, when he needed to blend winds as an ensemble to blend with the strings, because they were all about blend. Mm. But on the stage, they had to deal with these microphones because there was really very little you could do mixing and EQing and stuff like that. You know, it was...
Right. You had to get really, it right from the beginning.
You had to get it
interesting.
Right from the beginning.
That's very interesting about the woodwind setup.
Well, you can see, it makes sense, right? Because
if
you want winds to like... You want to feel them, but you don't want to really hear them unless it's a solo. If it's an oboe, you know, like that.
It's just a color.
You write the oboes in a certain range because in a certain range they don't stick out. The clarinets can be like almost inaudible in any range. It's part of the way you can play a clarinet. Bassoons, you can't do that. You know, he might blend bassoons with horns, which bassoons blend very well with horns, whatever. But the idea was to blend. When he wanted to blend, that's what you would do. You'd have a big choir of clarinets that would help blend the woodwinds. And the brass were like, a lot of them were in these big bands, like these Harry James band was the ones that my dad used to use. You know, they did a lot of those films too, you know, swing films and big brassy, you know, films and stuff too. So they had a certain style that they did with that too, which really was a big band with orchestra.
Okay.
He did the Newman system. He did the Klicks and Streamer system, 1933, 34. Oh. He developed the streamers and the flutters because most of them were doing it with a sweep hand clock. You put the timing and the score and you'd watch a clock. But, you know, here's your stand, here's the clock, here's the orchestra, and here's the movie. So my dad was a really good conductor. So he wanted it to be like he's in a pit, in an opera pit. And what in an opera pit, you're looking up. So now it's on the film, all the sync stuff. So you can look at your orchestra, which is really important, and you can look at the film, which is what you're performing to.
Yeah.
So he developed this thing of these streamers, these lines that go across, and flutters, so that you on as a sort of buoy sync places.
Yeah.
And then the streamers are like.
How did they make those?
They scratch. They take a work print and like a streamer, 3 foot streamer, 5 foot streamer, or 1.5 foot streamers, depending on how long you wanted it to take to go across. And then the flutters, they just punch a couple of holes in the film.
And isn't that true?
Like, and it's scientific.